All right, it's time for the futures.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. Ladies and gentlemen, KSCO presents the Dr. Future Show. If you would like to join in our show today, you can call us at 831-479-1080. That's 831-479-1080. And now, your host, Dr. Future.
Hey, folks, welcome to another great week. Beautiful day today in Santa Cruz. A little chilly, but sunny and sort of warm. 56 degrees, something like that.
You are always giving the weather report first, Dr. Future.
You never know, because our audience is all over the planet. And you never know when they're going to be watching from the podcast. But this so they know that we just came in from a beautiful, sunny 56-degree Fahrenheit.
Santa Cruz is still warm and lovely.
In the middle of winter.
It's the end of February.
Yeah. So we have a very special show for you today. You know how often we've spoken about autonomous vehicles and the future of transportation and flying cars, all kinds of stuff that deal with moving molecules around on this planet. Well, in the second hour, we're going to be talking more in depth with that.
So everybody out there who's suffering in too much traffic, don't worry. The cure is coming. The ideas are here. People are selling them. The infrastructure exists. We just have to realize it and activate it. And that's what we're going to be talking about today.
Meanwhile,
that's the future.
Yes,
what about the here and now?
Here and now. In this hour, we've got a bunch of really cool stories that came up this week. And related to transportation, there was a very interesting update on Waze. I don't know how many of you use Waze as part of your...
If you're not aware of Waze, you are definitely in the slow lane.
Yeah.
Wayne is the crowdsourced traffic information app, and it's my very favorite, and it has been for a while. Well, you get a chance to tell Waze where you are and what you see in terms of traffic conditions.
Right.
And Waze tells everybody what is going on in traffic. And
it's crowdsourced.
Very good.
If people see cops on the side of the road, they let each other know. You know, you're probably familiar with this. Google Maps, Apple Maps, and Waze have the lion's share of directions for people.
The big apps.
Yes, and when you get used to these, it's hard to go back to anything else. So,
like radio stations, I guess we don't really get our traffic
information.
Well,
you don't get directions, you get traffic.
Waze.
But
radio stations tell you why it's happening. Waze will tell you where it's happening.
Where to go or what exit to get off at based on where you are in order to avoid it, that sort of thing. Well, some informal testing by a manager at Adobe found that Apple's estimated trip times, how long it takes you to get to destination, were typically about 8% longer than the trip actually took.
So Apple gets you there extra early. Apple gives you 8% of your driving time to be off a little bit due to unforeseen conditions and just to be relaxed when you walk through the door.
That's right. Yeah, so you have a little bit of slack time. The Apple Maps, 8%, resulted in an arrival time that was usually a little bit faster than what was predicted.
So they predict a time that is 8% off from other apps, but you arrive at a time that is 1% off from what they told you? Is that something like that?
It's giving you a conservative estimate, so you have a good experience when you arrive a little bit earlier than anticipated.
Mm-hmm.
But the directions themselves, interestingly enough, are not as fast as what you would get with Waze or Google Maps.
Right. So when Apple tells you your estimated time, it tells you you're going to get there in 40 minutes. And Google will tell you you're going to get there in 37 minutes. And Waze tells you you're going to get there in 37 and a half minutes. Something like that, right?
No, if it's speed that you want, Google Maps is the superior choice. Navigation done with Google Maps was 5% faster than done with Apple Maps.
Mm-hmm.
And if you switch over to Waze, which is owned by Google, I might add, then things get even faster. Navigation using Waze was about 6% faster than Apple Maps.
Okay.
And this was all an informal study done by an engineer, Artur Grabowski, at Adobe, who spent the majority of 2017 collecting data on Apple Maps, Google Maps, and Waze.
Can you imagine how much time he was spending in traffic if he collected that much data on mapping programs?
Well, he probably was a commuter to the area.
I'm guessing. He probably was not in an autonomous car. He probably had to drive, or somebody, maybe he was in the commuter lane and he got to be a passenger he was seeing how fast. Because Waze makes you have a navigator. They ask you,
are you the driver?
Are you the driver? And they will not give you the information if you're the driver. You have to say, no, I'm a passenger.
Yeah, well, how many people figured out what to push to get that?
Well, it's not that you can't fool the AI. It's that they're trying to make it safe.
They're trying, yeah, exactly. So I thought you'd like to know, and that'll fit in very nicely in what's coming up on the show.
That's true. Traffic is all over the headlines. There's traffic in the Bay Area. Congestion is driving a lot of people crazy, and there's a lot of big money at stake to do something about it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, another thing that we've often talked about is how AIs are starting to take over jobs more and more. It was a very interesting piece in Inc. this week about software that allows artificial intelligence to do what a group of lawyers do.
Uh-oh. The next profession on the chopping block.
That's right.
Lawyers.
Law geeks. LAWGEEX.
Mm-hmm.
Watch out, attorneys. The bots are coming. And they're getting good at your job. Law geeks is, first of all, it's not an American company. It's a Tel Aviv-based startup. And it creates software that uses AI to study contracts. And it flags any language or stipulations that seem out of the ordinary in contracts. So they released their software to the public last year, and recently the company decided it wanted to put it to a test. So in a study overseen by some attorneys from Duke and Stanford universities, the startup got 20 experienced lawyers to study 5 new NDAs, or non-disclosure agreements, and the AI, the artificial intelligence, did the same.
So this is a race between the lawyers and the AI.
Yeah.
This has kind of moved a long way since the days where Go was becoming dominated by computers over the world champion Go players.
Or John Henry and his hammer. The lawyers came in at a solid 85% accuracy.
Okay.
And the software, the AI, 94%.
Was it multiple choice?
No, this was looking at irregularities in NDA contracts.
You know,
weird clauses.
You had to actually read the contract and then decide if there's something weird about it.
That's right.
So there's a right answer, and the lawyers were
there was 85%
of the time.
Well, it was more about irregularities, weird things. Like if it wasn't quite the normal languaging, like somebody was trying to slip something in on you.
Oh, so it was recognition of irregularities.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the average lawyer took 92 minutes to complete the task. The company's AI did it in 26 seconds.
Uh-oh.
So in addition to being more accurate.
So much for hourly billing.
It's a couple hundred times faster.
Yeah. Wow. Well, let's just think about the disruptive effects of that while we go to the break.
Okay. And then if you want to know more, the Inc. article links are on our links page.
All right, folks.
DrFutureShow.com/links.
Stay tuned for more from the Dr. Future Show here on KSEO. We'll be back in a couple minutes.
Welcome back to the show, folks. Very interesting this week also was a piece in Independent magazine on how Sweden's recycling programs have been so successful that the company has run out of rubbish. Run out of rubbish. Can you believe it?
What a first-class problem. Not enough trash?
Yeah, the country has to import rubbish from other countries to keep its recycling plants going.
Oh, I wonder if our exporters have heard that. I know China's not taking it anymore, so Sweden is.
Send us your garbage. Yes, they're so good at recycling that they've imported rubbish to keep it going. Less than 1% of Swedish household waste was sent to landfill last year.
That is astounding.
We can only dream of this kind of effectiveness in the U.S., which is why we end up paying expensive transport cars to send garbage to recycle overseas, like to China. Rather than paying fines to send it to landfill.
Well, those days are coming to an end. China is saying no more importing of trash from other countries.
It's about time, eh?
Yeah.
I mean, so that we can start to use it for our own advantage.
I mean,
because
the
garbage is really molecules that can be recycled. It's just a question of being able to do it effectively.
There you go. So we need better systems for dealing with garbage. Maybe there should be no such thing as garbage. We have to turn everything into useful inputs.
Yes. Now, why is Sweden so far ahead of everyone else? Well, because they were the first countries to implement a heavy tax on fossil fuels back in 1991. And now their sources of electricity are 50% renewable now.
Hmm. So they even the price of fossil fuels with other forms of energy switched to renewables, and now they don't have trash.
Incineration centers produce enough electricity to supply 250,000 homes in each incineration center.
So they were burning
heating. Well, they
trash.
Do two things. Well, that's true. They have a very efficient incineration system for much of the rubbish. They also have a heating system for that incineration as well. Like they can, one center can do 950,000 homes for heating and 250,000 for electricity.
So trash is no longer trash, it's fuel for heat.
For heat and electricity.
Wow.
And you know, Swedish people are keen on being out in nature, so they're very aware of environmental issues. And this is an example of what can happen if you have the cultural will to do something like this. They have a cohesive national recycling policy so that even though private companies do most of the business of importing and burning waste, the energy goes into the national heating network to heat homes through the very cold winter that they have there. That's really important to them, is the heat from the burning. Now, some critics claim that burning trash is not the best way to get rid of it, even if it's ecologically done. That paper, for example, is best recycled because you can get 5, 6, 7 times the use of paper if you recycle the pulp rather than just turn it into ash.
Hmm.
So even their system could be dramatically improved by more effectively recycling paper goods into other paper goods rather than turning it
into burning fuel.
Into ash. So that's one of the big arguments about their system.
What an argument. How can we make our trash a more efficient fuel? How can we recycle our trash more often before we burn it? That's
right. That's what they're thinking about.
We're not asking questions like that around here, I can tell you.
Well, some people think that way.
Yeah, it's good to think that way.
Yeah. Interesting example of what's possible given a little focus on a national scale.
All right.
Data has just recently come out on the costs of renewables. The good news there is that clean energy just became the cheapest source of electricity.
Yay!
In our country.
All right, we can save money by buying renewables and have a steady retreat from things that pollute the planet.
That's right. A recent bidding process for the utility giant Xcel Energy rocked the industry just recently. They were asking for bids for clean energy projects to include solar, wind, and batteries. And the alternative energy bids came in lower than anything ever seen before. What was interesting is that when they put out the bid, they just didn't get dozens of bids. They got hundreds of bids.
So there's more energy providers than ever before.
Ever before. And the rock bottom prices that they were offered were the average of all the bids. So the response to their solicitation was unprecedented.
Okay.
Now, just to give you a little background, Xcel is an $11 billion gas and electric utility giant that serves 3.3 million people in 8 states. Colorado is one of the main states. Last year, Xcel reached an agreement to shut down 2 Colorado coal plants 10 years earlier than planned. But there was a hitch because the plants would only be shut down if Xcel could replace their 660 megawatts of power with lower cost clean energy alternatives. That's last year, last August, they put out a solicitation for bids to see what the market would offer. The last time they did that, they had gotten 55 bids, but this last year they got 430 bids. 251 of those bids included solar, 119 wind, and 105 including storage. Now, storage is where you're not just generating the energy, you're storing it in batteries.
Okay.
And it's a fairly new component
but
in the equation.
But you need that in a place where you have cold weather, short days, and not enough sunshine to last all night.
Right. And according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration, or EIA, a new coal plant would produce electricity at about 12 to 14 cents per kilowatt hour. But, you know, today no one's building new coal plants. So analysts went look at the marginal cost, so just the cost of running an existing coal plant, and that's averaged to be about 3.6 cents per kilowatt hours, 2.5 cents for coal, and 1.1 cents for operations and maintenance. And so then the collective floor jaw went slack when bids for wind came in to XL at 1.8 cents per kilowatt hour and solar back at 3 cents.
Oh my goodness. That is a fraction of the cost.
Yeah.
Wow.
Of course, it would be fair to point out that solar and wind are not true replacement for coal because they only run intermittently. So you need to consider storage as part of that.
So it's not an apples to apples comparison.
Well, you need to include storage in the wind and solar bid
to be
compared with coal. Well, actually, coal doesn't really save. Actually, they produce it based on what's needed.
Well, yeah, coal is stored in big piles of coal. I mean, there is storage inherent
in
the system.
Burn more coal, right. Uh-huh. So it's coal that has the advantage of actually being a storage of energy as well as...
The problem with solar is that it's energy that's on the move. So if you want to use it when the sun isn't shining, you have to have access from somewhere else. And that's what storage is for. That's what batteries... You can't have a really functional solar system without batteries.
What surprised them was the low cost of storage. Storage can be expensive, but in these bids, the average bid for wind, for example, plus storage came in at 2.1 cents, and solar plus storage was 3.6 cents per kilowatt hour. So yes, that's 3.6 cents per kilowatt hour for solar plus storage. It's the same as the marginal cost of operating a coal plant. Just reaching that point where trade-off. It's economically viable.
Well, you know, in the future, solar is going to become cheaper and coal is going to become more expensive. So what kind of infrastructure do you want to invest in?
Well, this is a tectonic event when we're switching the source of our fuels like this, and when the price is this competitive.
Uh-huh. The teeter-totter just tipped to the other side.
Yeah. With this storage, the bids are cost competitive. So this is an emerging story on clean energy. It started out as a way to help the planet, people who cared about the planet, cleaning up the dirty old power plants, but it's becoming a story about saving money. Now, which everyone can relate to.
All right. Save money and save the planet you're doing it.
So we can have our cake and eat it too.
Wow.
With wind, sun, and batteries, that looks like the magic combination.
Sign me up. The future's so bright, you got to wear shades.
Yeah.
You're getting a lot of solar power.
So you want to know more about that? We have a nice link to that in our links page as well, just to show you that it's happening.
Wow. Good on you, Colorado. Good on you, XL Power.
There's a new type of solar cells that's being tried out. They're transparent solar cells. And if this is successful, it'll turn all the world's glass surfaces into solar panels.
All glass, everywhere.
Yeah it's possible.
Any
transparent,
window.
Semi-transparent, light harvesting materials are just starting to emerge in the last few years. And there's already beginning to get some commercial examples of them. Nature had a big piece in that. Singularity Hub has been reporting on this. The authors of these reports estimate that there's somewhere in the region of 5 to 7 billion square meters of glass surface in the U.S. And then coating this with a transparent solar cell material could generate 100 gigawatts of power, enough to make the flux capacitor possible. Gigawatts.
Right.
100 gigawatts of power.
Get ready for powerful glass. All right, Dr. Future will be back after this break.
Radio? Why should I advertise on radio? There's nothing to look at, no pictures.
Listen, you can do things on radio you couldn't possibly do on TV.
That'll be the day.
All right, watch this. Okay, people, and now when I give you the cue, I want the 700-foot mountain of whipped cream to roll into Lake Michigan, which has been drained and filled with hot chocolate. Then the Royal Canadian Air Force will fly overhead towing a 10-ton maraschino cherry, which will be dropped into the whipped cream for the cheering of 25,000 extras. All right, cue the mountain. Cue the Air Force. Cue the maraschino cherry. Okay, 25,000 cheering extras. Now, you want to try that on television?
Well...
You see, radio is a very special medium because it stretches the imagination.
Doesn't television stretch the imagination?
Up to 21 inches, yes.
Yeah, I like that commercial. I think we should have more sound effects, Mrs. Future. We can take it a little further.
I'm wide open, Dr. Future.
Right. I did have a soundboard at one point. Yeah. Well, next show.
One?
Well, not this week. Next week, but I've got something to plan here.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah. I could use it for this next story, actually.
Really? Well, try and emulate it. Give us a rendition. What's this sound effect that you're thinking?
Well, this is a new airplane, folks. This is bigger than any airplane that's ever been flown. Well, Mrs. Future, I think we need some other...
Trying to improvise.
Yeah.
I'm sure you have a perfect one in mind. Yeah. We'll retell this story next week.
Well,
the big airplane story with sound effects.
You think? Okay. Well, it's called the Strato Launch. It's the world's biggest aircraft and the largest all-composite plane ever manufactured. Financed by another one of those tech billionaires, Paul Allen.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. This one's built at the Mojave Air and Spaceport. The megaplane has two plane fuselages right next to each other, two fuselages connected by a center wing and outfitted with six, count them, six Boeing 747 engines, three on either side. It can carry 500,000 pounds. Its job, if it all goes according to plan, which hopefully it will be deliver rockets into space. Three rockets, to be exact, along with servicing satellites. It'll work with companies like SpaceX and another one called Terrabella, which you may not have heard of yet.
Yeah, I haven't heard of Terrabella.
It's a quick and precise sat positioning system that will be a competitor to the typical rocket launches used for putting payloads into space now.
We're talking and about Stratolaunch.
Stratolaunch. And the idea here is that you move something up to 40, 50,000 feet, and that reduces the amount of atmosphere and gravity that you need to deal with in order to get into low Earth orbit. And so this could be another approach that just might be successful.
So even though this launch is about a future mission to outer space, or rather inner space, you're just past the atmosphere, you're in the gravity zone. But this
you're flying like a high-flying commercial jetliner up in those regions.
Right.
Maybe a little bit higher.
And this airplane looks like a scaled-up version of the plane that won the XPRIZE.
Yes, it's a similar concept. Similar concept to Burt Rutan's XPRIZE winner, where you would fly the rocket up to 40,000 feet and then launch the rocket from that height. From the mothership. So this would be the mothership.
Okay.
A Strato launcher. A bigger one, a bigger version of the same concept.
They're using airplanes to launch rockets is basically the Strato launch strategy.
It's a heavy-duty, dual-fuselage aircraft with the rockets between the fuselage.
And the size of this is just amazing. The wingspan is...
385 feet.
385 feet.
Yeah, according to their
All right.
data.
That's like a football field, right?
My, oh my. That's right.
What kinds of things can fly?
They are testing it out on the runway in Mojave. They haven't really gotten it in the air yet. But the latest test, they took it up to 25 knots on the ground. And the takeoff speed for the plane is like 130 to 150 knots. So they're working their way up to actually lifting off, which should be soon.
Wait a minute. You're saying that all this fuss is about an airplane that can't get off the ground?
Well, I didn't say that. It's going to get off the ground. It's a future thing, Mrs. Future. But it's in process, you know.
But the big headline is that this giant airplane went 40 knots on a runway.
25 knots.
25 knots on a runway.
Yes.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, but it's huge. It's a step forward. I mean, look, you know, okay.
All right.
It's not the biggest. It's incremental steps here. I suspect by the end of the year, we might see something more dramatic.
All right. Well, let me just fast forward to my sci-fi imagination of the future of this jet plane.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Well, you know how we're always tracking the development of robots and technology. So I'm imagining a day when the robots from the movies that are taller than skyscrapers are walking around the planet, and they'll pick up this little jet and throw it into the upper atmosphere like a paper airplane.
That big a robot, huh?
Yeah.
You're a giant robot plus. Plus-sized robot.
There you go. Well, humanity, we like to grow bigger.
Yeah.
Let's hope we can do it in a fun and safe way.
Yes. Well, this is called the Strato Launch.
Strato.
The world's biggest aircraft.
Okay. So thanks for that news.
We'll keep you posted on that front. Let's go to Proxima B for a minute. It's another good sound effects one.
Proxima B.
Yeah. You heard of Proxima B? You don't know, of course, that there are lots of stars and they all represent different solar systems and the universe, right? And we're just one of them out of billions and all.
Sure.
We all know this.
We're Sol.
Well, you know the closest one to us?
Proxima A? No.
Arcturus? Alpha Centauri.
Alpha Centauri. There we go.
Yes. 4.2 light years from here. It takes 4.2 light years to get there, or light 4.2 years to get here from there. Well, we're kind of looking favorably towards this star system as being maybe one of the first places our species would visit once we become a space-faring civilization and are able to get out there.
Just because it kind of seems like it's
close,
in the neighborhood.
4.2. I mean, if we travel super fast, we'll get there in 4.2 years, right?
Less than, no.
But we're more likely 40 years.
We will not be able to go at the speed of light.
No,
we
40
will
years,
have
maybe.
To go at like a fraction of the speed of light.
We're excited because our astronomers found there was a planet that was in the Goldilocks zone around Proxima B, one of the star system there. And
so it's just the
good.
Right distance
it's
from
the, right distance.
The star.
It's just the Goldilocks zone is where you have liquid water on the planet. It's a planet about the right size.
It's warm enough
like
to
that.
Melt ice.
Well, the difference is that the star system there in the Proxima B is the M-class red dwarf.
Okay, that's Star Trek talk for we could M-class, live there.
Yeah, well, it's much smaller than our sun.
Oh.
Much, much smaller. And so the planet is much closer to the sun than we are to our sun.
So ice can melt, but it's you're really close to that star.
Yeah. What concerns us about this, it was something we just noticed that happened there. As we were watching the Proxima B, it barfed out this high energy flare.
Stars do that, don't they?
Yeah. And it looks like it radiated the planets nearby.
Oh, no.
And
Proxima B fried its planets?
Yeah, or Meredith McGregor, an astronomer at Carnegie Institution, confirmed this with the detection of this colossal flare from Proxima Centauri that occurred March 24th last year.
So much for harvesting ice cubes around Proxima B.
No. And they said, well, what would the flare do to the planet? They said, well, if it had an ocean like ours, it would vaporize the ocean.
Darn.
So whatever life there might have not
That's
be there anymore.
That's it.
It was blasted
by
high energy right in its
billion
face.
Billion years of evolution.
Yeah.
Gone.
Evaporated
in an instant.
The atmosphere of the ocean, sterilized the surface right in front of us.
Oh, poor Proxima B.
Yeah. So hope it doesn't happen here. The good news is that our star system doesn't have these type of flares and we're much further away. Yeah, red dwarfs are known for having violent barfing of radiation.
Really? Red dwarfs like our very own Sol?
No, we're not a red dwarf.
Oh, what are we?
No, what are we?
We're a red giant.
Red giant. There you go. Not a red dwarf.
Right.
There you go. Big difference.
Big difference. Let's see.
Published today.
All right. We have a caller.
Week. Yeah.
Can you take a moment
before
we
move
on?
Sure. Let's talk about Sure.
Okay. Mark from Monterey wants to say something about Israel's energy plan. Hi, Mark from Monterey. Welcome to the show.
Hey there.
Hey, thank you. I just was reading in the Times of Israel that the energy minister presented a plan to reduce pollution because, yes, I think 2,500 people die from excess pollution in Israel every year.
Wow.
So at this point, they are about, 71% natural gas. And interestingly, in 2014, they were about 50-50 coal production and natural gas to produce electricity.
Mm.
Right now, they're 71% natural gas, about 27% coal, and 2% renewable. But by 2030, they're going to be 83% natural gas and 17% renewable and zero coal.
Nice. Now, why aren't they more solar, do you think? I mean, it seems like a desert would have much more solar capacity.
Yeah, you sure would think so. Although 17%, if they're 2% right now, that's a pretty big jump in renewables.
For sure.
The other interesting thing is that they said, so by 2030, they're going to be 83% natural gas and 17% renewables, but they're also going to not import any more gas or diesel vehicles. Wow. Cars.
So they're going to go maybe more electric at that point, huh?
They're going to have electric or possibly natural gas.
But where's Israel getting their natural gas from?
They have some big offshore oil fields. I guess the largest one's going to come on next year. They have been developing their natural gas, and they're actually starting to export it to other countries.
Oh, so it is one of their big resources right now. That's interesting.
Huh. Yeah, they just struck a deal with Jordan and Egypt. And so they think that strengthens their alliance in the area as far as energy security.
Yeah.
And obviously it's going to help with their air pollution and their sustainability.
Yeah, well, it's a step in the right direction for sure.
Okay.
Yeah,
good to
appreciate
thanks
that
so
info.
Much, Mark.
Thanks
appreciate
a lot, Mark.
That.
Yeah. Times of Israel, check it out.
Yeah, okay, Times of Israel. Fantastic.
Cool.
Yeah. Thank you.
Awesome. All right, you heard it here. We're going to go for a quick break and then more with Dr. Future.
Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. Two microbe stories dominate the news for us this week.
Tiny stories,
microbes,
giant headlines.
Dominate. Yes, one, microbes found in Earth's deep ocean might grow on Saturn's moon Enceladus.
Wow.
See, what fascinating
here. We
can
transport some extremophiles from Earth to Enceladus.
It seems like it's possible. Some very resilient Earth microbes might be able to thrive in the hidden ocean of Enceladus.
Well, they always say from the sea to the stars.
They say the icy moon of Saturn has become a prime candidate in the search for ET life. Scientists have cultivated a few of these tiny organisms from the bottom of our ocean that just might be the conditions that they would find in Enceladus. These microbes might survive in Enceladus. So they created, as much as we know about the oceans of Enceladus, they've recreated those conditions and put our microbes in those conditions. And they lived.
All right.
They lived.
So the little nano Enceladus lab is thriving with life.
Yes. So we could actually put microbes there if there weren't there already.
As long as there's nobody there to stop us.
Right. But we could actually seed them with life, Enceladus. Now, Enceladus is interesting because it also has geysers that suggest that there are hot vents in the ocean and that heated rocks there are creating warmth in those frigid waters. And so the mixing of hot and cold is creating this soup of chemicals that just might support life as we know it.
Great. From the hot tub to the ice pit.
Yeah. Our probes have found methane there, carbon dioxide, hydrogen, all of which are associated with a certain class of microbe that can survive without very much oxygen, an extremophile that doesn't need much oxygen. These little organisms, we know, gobble up CO2 and hydrogen, and then they release methane as a byproduct. So we're kind of looking for that there, and we're possibly find some evidence that this might exist. So those strains of microorganisms could be there. So we're going to look for them. Next time we go by there, we'll look for signs of their excretions.
All right. Yeah, maybe these extremophiles here came from there.
If you're a bit of a geek and you want to know about this type of microbes, just look up methanogenic archaea.
Ooh, okay.
Methanogenic, M-E-T-H-A-N-O-G-E-N-I-C, and then archaea is A-R-C-H-A-E-A.
Okay.
Deep sea cracks is where they live, near hydrothermal vents here.
Okay.
Yeah, like the Aiheia Ridge near Japan. So that's one microbe story that's kind of curious, huh?
Sure. Big and possibilities.
Yeah, yeah. And the other was the piece in the BBC News about the Atacama Desert in Chile.
Okay.
Scientists have examined soils in part of the Atacama Desert that haven't seen any rain for decades. It's super dry, driest place on the planet.
Hmm.
And the team from the Technical University of Berlin, Germany, found evidence of microbes that had adapted to these extreme conditions.
Okay, they didn't need any water for decades, and
decades.
They're still alive.
Very hardy.
Hard to imagine.
So all the stresses you have in the Atacama are similar in many respects to what you have on Mars. Okay. Just a little bit more on Mars, a little more extreme, but same kind of conditions.
Dry, no rain.
Super aridity, high levels of ultraviolet radiation, soils loaded with salts. They sampled the sites, several sites in the South American desert, and from places they get a regular wetting from fogs to see whether or not precipitation has any effect.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. They were able to get a freak rain event when they were studying it in 2015. And the presence of water, they found that the water hit the dryness. It metabolized microbes. In other words, there were microbes that, like, just add water. They come alive.
I see. Well, I've heard of sea monkeys. Yeah. I guess these are desert monkeys.
Yes, in the heart of the Atacama. And then, unequally unsurprisingly, they saw the level of that activity declined sharply as it dried out again. He went back to sleep.
The water is gone. Party's over.
Yeah. So where do they come from? You know, are they blown in by the wind or what? And so that's what they're studying now. They're looking at the genomic analysis of these microorganisms to see where they're from and what's going on with them.
All right. Big research into little tiny beings.
Research right now suggests that they're indigenous. And that the water comes, they become active. When it goes, they go back into a dormant state and wait for the next rain decades later.
Life will find a way.
So this could be how life persists on Mars today, if it was ever there in the first place.
Oh, so when we get to Mars, if we just add some earth water, the Martians are going to spring up from the soil?
It's possible. That's one of the tests they'll be doing.
Okay.
To see if there's any sea monkeys there. That's 4 billion. What we do know is that 4 billion years ago, there was a lot of water on Mars. That 4 billion years is quite interesting because it's 4 billion was when life began on this planet.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when they lost their life.
I see.
Then they lost their water.
Mm-hmm.
So could there have been some kind of migratory path from Mars to Earth?
Mm.
It's one of the questions on the
Yeah, some people say those microbes rode over here on Martian asteroids.
Well, it's kind of interesting because the 4 billion years is another interesting mark because that's when Venus lost its atmosphere too.
Hmm.
That's when it had the runaway greenhouse effect and became a nasty place to be.
Hmm.
So something happened 4 billion years ago that made Venus and Mars less favorable to biological life and Earth more favorable.
Hmm.
So something happened then.
Maybe we were just lucky and we were on the other side of the sun when it happened. And when we came back, all of a sudden our sibling planets were a mess.
A nasty thing. 4 billion years. That's the time to look at for that. I think the Earth was actually went from a Hadean state where it was like volcanoes and lots of crazy lava flows and acid atmospheres and that sort of thing and transformed into what it is today.
Hmm.
And this biological life began to shift the atmosphere here.
Oh.
It was part of the active process of change.
Right.
Those are the two microbe stories this week.
Cool.
Kind of interesting, yeah.
Like
and a related story, Newsweek had an interesting piece on how scientists have discovered that water and one of water's relatives, a hydroxyl, is distributed across the entire surface of the moon.
What? Water on the moon?
Yeah, and this contradicts earlier research that placed it mostly at the poles.
So wait a minute. Is hydroxyl the kind of water where you just have to add water?
That's a good question, Mrs. Future. I'm not an expert on the chemistry here. Let's see, OH, yes, let's see what it says here. The water exists in what's called a hydroxyl or an OH form. Hydroxyl is less ideal than H2O. It's more reactive relative to water and not as attractive as water. It's more ready, hydroxyls are more ready to attack molecules or stick to them than water.
Hmm.
That means explorers would need to extract it from minerals to actually use hydroxyl water.
Okay.
You have an extraction process, and that's energy to do that. But any H2O on the moon would be more steady and more accessible, and that's the stuff we know that's at the poles. But the hydroxyl form is throughout the entire sphere.
It's just an interesting way to think about it, that when you reduce it all to the chemicals, the chemistry, the molecules, there's plenty of water everywhere. It's all made of hydrogen and oxygen.
It is, a lot, by and large. The next step, really, for our lunar studies is to determine where the water is, where the hydroxyls are, and a mixture of the two, and where they came from to did this water come from outside of the planet? Was it delivered by comets or asteroids, or was it an internal process of the moon itself, like some kind of volcanism within the planet that just created the preponderance of hydroxyl?
It's just amazing
molecules.
How when it comes to outer space, the more you know, the less you know.
Yeah. Or some kind of solar wind that deposited it on the
There
on
you
the
go.
Thing.
Right.
So we don't know a lot. I mean, we know a few things, but we don't know the origins of hydroxyl and water on the planet.
We're cosmic
moon,
detectives.
Mars, Venus, Enceladus.
We're looking for clues, then following our
cues. That's right. Getting there.
Getting there. Hey.
Yeah.
Speaking of getting there, you got
almost there.
About a minute.
I wanted to mention that there was a very interesting rare stellar explosion that an amateur citizen scientist captured. He was testing his new camera at a moment a supernova happened, and he caught it.
What a lucky guy.
Yeah. It was very important because how it explodes is what we don't understand. It's very rare to see them. There's maybe one every century in our galaxy. And to get it just at the right time is hard. Let's put
it's
it that
really
way.
It's really great. We've got so many people pointing telescopes
yes,
up at the
stars. That's where citizen science can come in. So they're looking at, we got one, and we're analyzing the data, and we're trying to figure out that event, what happens. Exciting. And we got a nice piece on that. Okay, next hour. By the way, that happened. The amateur astronomer was in Argentina that found this strange event.
As a couple of our guests who
are
coming
from Argentina
up in the next
and talking about
hour.
A new way of thinking about transportation and actually creating a working system here in the Bay Area.
All right. Stay tuned, folks.